Good morning. This is Kirk, and I'm with Scott today. How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Nothing like an adventure with just the two of us, right?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. CW can't make it today, and he's left the microphone with us, so we will. And he asked us to continue on with the Exodus story that we began last week. And I'm just going to give just a slight review of what we did and kind of give you a little overview of what we'd like to cover today if we have enough time. What we did, Scott, as you know, last week is we were talking about the Exodus story, and we covered the first 1 through 9 plagues. And along the way, what made it so interesting, at least to me, was that we could take the Torah's record, the ultimate record, and we found that there was the Apura scroll that mirrored it almost identically. And then with a few other things thrown in, we could see that, this story is the Egyptians, totally independently of Moshe's Torah, paralleled almost verbatim, and it was kind of the first time I'd read that many years ago. It was quite a revelation for me. I said, well, this stuff is being corroborated by the all sources. And today we'll get a little bit further along that way because we'll be able to incorporate the El Arish stone, which we'll cover in detail, some of the papyruses, and if we get to it, we'll cover a great many of the other historians who have dug up stuff over the last 100-something years that have once again proven, at least to me, have proven that the Torah story is extraordinarily accurate. So without further ado, I thought we'd move right into, we had left off through 1 through 9 and the plagues, and Yahweh sent all kind of horrible things are happening to the Egyptians and to the Hebrews that are there. There are plagues of bugs and fire out of the sky and hailstones and gosh, and earthquakes and so forth. And then we're down to the last plague, which is quite interesting. Now, a lot of my research, let me throw in one little thing before I talk too much. Most of my research on this came from an original researcher, which is by the name of Velikovsky. He was a doctor, a medical doctor, as well as a great student of history. He spoke about 20 languages. He was a tremendous, he put most of this stuff together. And I've kind of taken it and tried to make some sense of it through the view that we have as covenant members on how we can better understand the Torah through all this research. He was an atheist, however, and he didn't, and more in the mold of a scientist, where he wanted all the answers to be very concrete. And that's a little hang-up he has. I don't put God in a box. So what we'll be reading is just a record, and then we'll talk about all those different questions that arise. Now, on the problem, and the reason I brought Velikovsky up, and most importantly, is because he had a problem with the 10th plague. For him, he goes to Exodus 4:22 and 23, and 4:43:20 as a study on the word of chosen people, because, and also on the word firstborn. There's two words. There's Bachar or Bahar, depending on how you pronounce the chet, and there's also Bakar. And these two words, one of them means firstborn or the first fruit of the womb, and the other one can simply mean just the chosen, a youth, or a choices group. And the reason that becomes important is because Yahweh has said in the Exodus story that he would kill the firstborn sons of the Egyptians. And his debate was, and we might as well put it out on the table just so everybody will know, Velikovsky's point of view was that it doesn't have to be every firstborn child in Egypt, can, but it doesn't have to be based on which word is chosen. Whether it's a chosen, or a firstborn. And the problem with that is we don't have it in the Dead Sea Scrolls, Scott, so we can't really go back and say this is a definitive answer to what the word was that was selected in the Torah. But regardless, that debate aside on whether it's this word or that word, there was a great catastrophe, and Pharaoh's family, family at least was killed. We know that his child was killed, his firstborn was killed, and there's a lot of evidence that thousands were killed. So here, let's go right into the Torah on what it says in the with these two words that we'll consider. At midnight, Yahweh smote all the firstborn and all the select of Egypt, or it could say, Yahweh smote all the strength of Egypt, or it could say that Yahweh smote the chosen of Egypt. And therein lies the rub. But regardless of what it is, I don't have a bone to pick on this in this regard, that Yahweh could choose to kill off a group of them. He could choose to kill every male firstborn. He could also use a combination of an earthquake that destroyed a lot of these people, as well as he could use a malach, a messenger, what we call an angel, a Nuen Yelion, a messenger who came and destroyed those. My question to you, Scott, is most of the time I think of angels in this sense, or malach in this sense, as spiritual messengers, and I think of them more in this regard of the Exodus, that they were there to protect the chosen, the children, the Israelites, and they don't necessarily have to, but they could be the ones responsible for killing the firstborn children. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, they do whatever Yah tells them to do. So, I mean, if he said, I mean, obviously they, I feel like they keep the chosen safe. So, if keeping the children, the chosen safe was to eliminate the firstborn sons, I could see them carrying that out.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to do whatever they will do, and this goes all the way down to Hasatan. Mm-hmm. They just do what they're commanded to do.
Right.
They don't have a choice in what they do. So, yeah. I mean, if that's what they were told to do, then yeah, I'd have to agree with you that they'd be the ones to carry it out.
Yeah. Well, that's the argument on what had happened. His biggest argument is he can't stand the involvement of something outside of scientific or outside of something very practical, that an earthquake did this or this happened and that happened. But
I mean,
because you will read things about that on both sides, I thought it best to go ahead and put it out there. I personally don't really care whether Yahweh used an angel to pull this off or whether he used an earthquake that destroyed a lot of things. But let's go through the...
Maybe they just...
Or a combination of the two.
Maybe there was just a bacteria or something.
Yeah.
He said this bacteria...
Well, no, here's why this won't happen. And let's go into the 10th plague, and we're going to do a comparison of what Apura's papyrus said versus the Exodus, and let's see if we can find the answer in this combination. Death struck instantly, and it took the victims from every house. Apura's papyrus states that the residence is overturned in a minute, or to be overthrown in a minute. Now, that's probably only a good fit for something like an earthquake, because if you're using a quick moment of time, it couldn't be a plague. It would have to be either an angel, or it'd have to be an earthquake that kills a vast majority of people, and that would kill off most of the firstborn, perhaps. In Exodus, as a comparison, for instance, in 12:30, the Pharaoh rose up in the night, and he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. Now, the word he used is when it comes to smote, in the next line, which is, we're going to go back to 12:29, and it says, and it came to pass that at midnight Yah smote all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on the throne unto the firstborn of the captive that were in a dungeon. And the word he used was nagaf for smote, which is a violent shock or a violent blow. So if it happened very, very fast, that would fit with an earthquake, or it would fit if a malach was doing it as well.
Also, if it was an earthquake, having it happen at night would be the time where you would catch those children away from
everybody
their parents
at home.
to where they couldn't be protected.
But I want to draw your attention to the fact that in Exodus he talks about the throne of the firstborn of the captive that were also in the dungeon. They're in the prison. In the papyrus 4:3, also in 5:6, he says the children of the princes are dashed against the walls. And then he says the children of the princes are dashed out into the street. Well, that's a violent thing against the wall. That would be an earthquake. And then he goes on to say in Papyrus 6:3, and we're still talking about Apura here, he says the prison is ruined. Now, what's fabulous, regardless of what we can figure out, well, how it all happens, is that it's amazing to me that Apura is recording exactly the same events that the Exodus is, down to the finest little detail. So the prisons are ruined, and the people in the prisons are dying. It doesn't have to be, in other words, it just doesn't have to be either or proposition, because Yahweh can do what he wants. And then in Exodus 12:30 we move to, and it says, at the end, there was a great crying in Egypt. And then Papyrus 3:14, it says, it is a groaning that is throughout the land, mingled throughout all of Egypt. Wow. So everywhere we find the Exodus story, it goes on and on. It is parallel with Apura. Now, let's go on a little bit further, and forgive me for having to read some of this, because I need to quote all these things so y'all can think about it. But y'all warned them earlier in Exodus 12:12, this night against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am Yahweh. Artapanus, which is no longer extant, was quoted from some unknown source, and he quoted, which is also quoted by Eusebius, who said that all the temples fell. So Yah has put quite a havoc on everything that resembles any god of Europe is destroyed, and we talked a little bit about that last week. And from what it's worth, Ginsberg, who wrote the Legends of the Ancient Legends, volumes and volumes, he was another historian. He said as many as 9/10 of the inhabitants have perished as far as his records could figure out. So I think the lesson is that Yah would destroy this civilization. We're going to find that he destroyed most of the crops, as we did last week, and also he destroyed their homes and the institutions, the military, economic, government, religious institutions, and he did it very, very quickly. He has to do it rather quickly. This thing has to happen very quickly because, as you know, we're approaching Passover, and Passover is the first of a new year. Not only does they have to get out to the desert to fulfill Passover or to celebrate Passover, they are both there and all the way till we get to Mount Horeb. But you also, God's put himself on a timeline for 400 years that they would be in Egypt, and they have to move out. And we'll find some other reasons why they're going to need to get out in a hurry as well. So he destroyed everything rather quickly, and he took away their children and took away their future. And, of course, Yahweh took away the slave labor force, which rendered them without much of a chance to rebuild, certainly not in any quick period of time. And then Apura, let's go back to Apura here for a minute for some more parallels, just to prove Yahweh's story. Apura 6:7 and 7:5-6, he said, men, just to give you the description, he said, men ventured to rebel against Eresus. Eresus, by the way, is Pharaoh's, or the emblem of the royal house, which is Pharaoh's house, and that the magical spells connected with the serpent are divulged, that gold and jewels, are fastened to the neck of the female slaves. Now, I thought, gosh, that's an odd thing to say till you think about it just a minute. We've got, obviously, they were rebelling because, or questioning their Pharaoh. That's what Apura was all about. You've also got a mention of the serpents, which was divulged, a magical spell that Apura is writing about, which tells you about the Moshe. I would connect that to the Moshe story. And then this odd little thing at the very end of this this section where he says that gold and jewel are fastened to the neck of the female slaves. Go to Exodus 11:2 and you find out, and he says, God says to, or Moshe says for on behalf of God, and let every man borrow of his neighbor and every woman of her neighbor jewels and silver and gold. And then in 12:33, Exodus, and the Egyptians were urgent upon the people that they might send them out in haste, for they said, we be all dead men. They obviously were trying to get rid of, after all the plagues they've been going through, they obviously wanted to get these people going, and they gave them anything they wanted and gave them quite a lot of wealth. So that parallels, again, the same story as defined in Exodus. Now, when the slaves leave, there's about 600,000 men and women and children, and a large number, by the way, of Egyptians, too, which people forget. And then, unfortunately, the Pharaoh soon follows. The papyrus that Ippur wrote in 712 records only that the Pharaoh was lost under very unusual circumstances, and he says that that has never happened before, that the Pharaoh went and never came back. So now we have a royal house, no army, no temples, all the buildings are ruined. The slaves are gone, we've got dead bodies in the streets and diseases everywhere, and everyone is looting. Ippur records that the years of noise from a continuing violent contractions, that the roads are impassable and there's anarchy. Well, I live in California, so earthquakes have aftershocks, and that went on for quite a long time. So he's recorded that as well. Some observations that I also had that I'd like to toss in, if I may. The above story, to me, proves that the Exodus story was recorded correctly. There are more sources than that can confirm this history. And in the Hermitage in Leningrad, there's another papyrus, which is numbered for those who want to go do their homework. There's 116B, recto, and recto just means it's the papyrus of what is written on the front page of the papyrus. Verso would be on the back page of the papyrus. And it cites the collapse of Egypt and an invasion of a nomad kings. And then I asked the question, well, who are they? And they were called the Egyptian king shepherds. The Egyptians had a name for that. It was called Amu or Amu. And that's a name for the Amalekites, also known as Hyksos. And they seem to have four, I can't get a number on this, no matter what I do, they either had four or six kings. But we do know that Apo the First and Apo the Second was the first and the last one, and they're also called Agog. Now, don't let all these names throw you. It'll all make sense in a minute. Agag or Agog, the first and second. And they reigned, or actually they destroyed. Well, they did reign, but they also continued to destroy Egypt, or at least what was left of Egypt. And their names were found on this trough that was being used by a Bedouin tribe to water their cattle. And in about 1890, and the archaeologist that found it, he saw it as black granite with hieroglyphics on it. And after he studied it, he found that it had Popi the First and Second, whose names were inscribed there upon it. And he also found it was found at the border. This is significant, I'm sorry. He found it at the border of Egypt and Israel. And in a minute, I'll tell you why that's kind of important as well, the location that it was found. And the stone that he found, or this big trough, is called the El Ardish stone. And what's significant about that is that it records for our friend Dr. Jeff, it records that on there it has some Hebrew alphabet on it. One of them is the Pei and the other is the Gimel. So this is a very, very, very old stone, and is found at El Ardish, which will be a significant player in the story of the Amalekites. But we're still in the 10th plague. But I want to switch just for a minute. I'll come back to El Ardish in just a second. But we want to go to that papyrus 1116. This record, it is claimed to have been written as a prophecy, but what it is or not, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. But what it is, it's recorded as such, and it says on that papyrus, which was also found at the same time that they found the El Ardish stone, the prophecy goes on to say that Egypt was totally destroyed. It had darkened skies where the sun veiled by the clouds, which is the same description that the Torah has. Bedouins invaded the land. Foes in the east and the Asiatic descended into Egypt. And the land is upside down, and none there is to weep for all the dead, because there's so much dead. A thick veil of clouds over the desert is mentioned repeatedly throughout the Torah about this situation that's going on during the Exodus. And it goes on to say that the liberation of the king, this is the prophecy now on the papyrus, it goes on to say that the liberation by a king would be born of a Nubian woman and called Ammoni. And the Ammu, or the Amalekites, shall fall by the sword. Now, the reason that's interesting, at least to me, it verifies Pura's story from a different source now. And it also tells about foreign invaders coming, which will be the Amalekites. And then it talks about the fall of them at some point, which it doesn't give a number. The tale reinforces the invasion by the Amalekites, but it also the people who expelled them. And what we can determine probably is that the one who is talking about is Amenhotep. And Amenhotep happened to be pictured, and he was the Pharaoh, but he also had to be, he was pictured as a black person. So if that's true, that would work out pretty well. Back to the El Ardi stone, though, that's the key one, I think. It's Hellenistic. It's from the Ptolemaic Age relic, and it's discussed. It discusses the dark period of King Tom, who is recorded as catching up to Moshe. So I don't know who the king, who the pharaoh was. In Roll's book, he talks about which pharaoh it was, but King Tom is the one that was called here in this particular on the El Ardi stone. And it says that the land was in great affliction. There was such a tempest that neither man nor gods could see the face of the next person next to them. And in Exodus on 10:22 and 23, there was a thick darkness in all the land of Egypt, and 3 days they saw not one another. Once again, we have another source saying exactly the same thing that Exodus is saying. We have at this location where the Pharaoh found them, it was actually called, and on this stone, it was actually called, it says, His Majesty Pharaoh finds them on a place called Phi Kharoti. That's Kharoti. In Exodus in 14:9, you've got the Egyptians pursue them. That's talking about Moses and the Hebrews. And the Egyptians pursue them and overtook them in camping by the sea by Phi-ha, Aroeth. The only difference in the words is the definite article of the he put in there. So I think that's pretty close. I think that'd be close enough for me that they're talking about exactly the same place where they're found. In addition to that, speaking of the El Ardi monument or the El Ardi stone, it also has the names written on it of the Amalekite pharaohs, which are first one and the last one, at least, of Apopi the First and Apopi the Second. So far, I think is pretty obvious that you can trust the Torah if you had any doubts before. But is that to me? It was rather amazing that so many of these things repeat and are so precise.
A lot of the same information from multiple sources.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what I'm hearing, and yeah. that makes it so. Yeah, I'm with you.
I'm not a radio person. I think if I just read a lot of this stuff, it's pretty obvious that this is pretty corroborating evidence.
Very much so. You can't dispute it.
Y'all forgive me for my lack of quality of radio voice, and we'll continue on here. El Ardi monument or stone, as it's called, it has another. I thought this was really interesting. It has an inscription on the shrine, and it says that the name of Pharaoh, who perished in the whirlpool, was Tom, T-H-O-M, or it could be phonetically T-H-O-U-M. Pithom is the abode of Tom, and the name of one of the two cities that were built by the Israeli slaves for the Pharaoh of oppression, as they called him, was called Pithom. Depending on where you put the emphasis on the syllable. The other was Ramses, the city of Ramses. And then we went to Manetho. He was a Greek historian. Now, his work is not extant, but we'll talk about him in a minute. But it is recorded in Josephus and a lot of other places verbatim. But this Manetho, the Pharaoh in whose days the blast of the heavenly displeasure, it says, that fell on Egypt preceded the invasion of the Hyksos, is called Tutmeos or Thiamos. So we have a lot of similar names, and unfortunately, they don't all spell the same, quite spell the same way in different things, but I think you can draw the conclusions pretty good. But the thing that's also interesting, it also talks about the Pharaoh being swept up in the whirlpool, and it also gives us a view of the Hyksos. That, now, remember, this Manetho is Greek, so he's writing the word for Amu or Amalekite. He's using a Greek word, which is where we get the word Hyksos. Let me ask you a question. We know that Yah can see the future, and he reports back in town what he saw in the future, right? So he knows what's happening.
Yep.
And in that regard, he would know in any geographic area, he would know what conditions will take place and what's going to be destroyed and so forth. If this is an earthquake and all these things happen, and I believe it were, just like God didn't send a flood to Noah, did he? There was a meteorite that hit below Saudi Arabia, the Merkel crater, right? God intervened to protect the people, and certain people he don't protect. God knew these things were happening. So I think it's reasonable to expect that for the scientific mind, it's not to understand that Yahweh already knew what was going to happen. He knew he was going to protect them. He gave them a timeline. He was going to put them in Egypt for 400 years, and then they would come out. And he knew these events were going to happen because he could go into the future, and he's light. He can go into the future. There's no time where he is. He's out of the dimension of time. So he can see what's going to happen and know what's going to happen. The thing that is so fascinating to me is twofold. He knows, prophecy tells us what's going to happen. And he knows, because he knows what's going to happen, he always seems to, the Hebrews always know ahead of time. These things were happening.
I think I know the answer for that.
Yeah?
Well, don't you warn the people you know?
Yeah, of course you do.
So the other people, you're not going to warn them because he doesn't know them.
He doesn't know them, and he doesn't care. Plus, these are the people that were hurting his people.
Yeah. So are
I
you
mean, they enslaved them. Brutal.
So he's not going to warn them.
No.
Yeah.
And he couldn't. These events would have happened if Yahweh had not intervened. They would have had an earthquake. All those things would have happened. But because he knew it, that was the time, and he had prophesied that's the time. It's just, those are rather, I don't know, maybe I'm overthinking this or something, but I think, wow, those are just wow factors for me, you know.
All of it's a wow factor.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, everything that you've said so far is kind of has that wow factor to it.
I wish I was more articulate, but it is, you know, just digging up the research for no other reason than to, just so that you have a clear understanding in your mind. Boy, these things really happen. I don't have to rely on this source completely. I can, you know, I can go here and find this. They've already mentioned the word Amalekites about 3, 4, 5 times. These are Bedouin people from Saudi Arabia, and we'll get to that in a minute as well. But I'll pass on that just a minute. The fun part is that Yahweh knew it ahead of time. He took care of his children like he promised he was going to do. He took them out of Egypt like he promised he would do in 400 years. And all these things happened. And the story is recorded everywhere. Let me throw one other question in there. I will ask this. We just really did the first one I was going to ask you or put out there that if Moshe hadn't arrived in time, would these events still have happened? Well, earthquakes still happened. It happened to the Greeks. It's recorded by the Greeks. It's recorded by the Minoan civilization. It's recorded. All these were big cataclysmic events. We've got the Iranian records, the Persians. We've got the Egyptian records. We've obviously got the Hebrew records now. And even Arabian records, mythology type of records are there. So those things would have happened, but I often ask the question, if Jericho hadn't shown up, would the walls have still fallen down? Well, that was an earthquake, too. Of course they would have. But the fun part is that Joshua, he called the shot. He knew they were coming down. So anyway, as we let's move on a little bit, so I won't bore y'all too much. As we have from Apura, about the Pharaoh, all he really tells us is a little small section about Apura, which I think I read last week, where he discusses that Pharaoh went away and never came back. You know, and they didn't know why or what happened, and that was also written up by Josephus as well. But here's some sources from the Josephus, and Josephus is quoting Manetho's. Manetho's was a Greek historian, and his work is not extant. He was obviously before Josephus, and Josephus, of course, was a Jewish historian during the Roman period. Not a good guy, but he did record. He says in his writings, in his Jewish Antiquities, he says that I am quoting Matthew exactly. He's not adding or subtracting anything. And so this source, if we is pretty good. So we can say that he said that the earth was darkened, and its majesty of show, remember this is the Greek from a Greek, went to battle against the companions of Apopi, the fierce guard of darkness. Now, believe it or not, this is the Egyptian calling Moshe the fierce guard of, the god that Moshe is representing as the fierce guard of darkness. Interesting, they used the name Apopi, and then later the first king to replace the Pharaoh, the first foreign king to replace the Pharaoh, also used the term Apopi. Very fierce name. And the king and his host never returned. So we have another verification from the Greek sources and Jewish records that's what happened. Now, when his majesty of Ra, Hamarchish, or Hara Cheti, fought with the evildoers in the pool, the place of the whirlpool, the evildoers prevailed not over his majesty. Now, this is Egyptian writing. His majesty left them to the so-called place of the whirlpool. Now, this is, I'll just cite some sources. This is from Griffin in the Antiquities of Tel El Yehuda. Or Yehudi, Udiye. I'm sorry about my pronunciation. This story is paralleled in Exodus 14, 27, and 28. It says, the sea returned to its strength, this is Yahweh talking, and the Egyptians fled against it. And Yahweh overthrew, or Moshe talking, recording, and Yahweh overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. And the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Now, this is the part where Pharaoh is in the demise or the perishing of Pharaoh in Exodus 15:19. For the horse of Pharaoh went in with his chariots and with his horsemen into the sea, and Yahweh brought again the waters of the sea upon them. That's exactly what they just said up in all these other things. I don't think he really jumped. I don't know about you, Scott, but I don't think he jumped in there. I think probably the wind was so strong. If it was a hurricane type of thing or tornado, he got swept up into it just like his troops were. They couldn't get out, and he was, because they describe it, all these people describe it as a whirlwind, a whirlpool. So I think he just got caught up in that circular air and was thrown into the sea with them when the water came back. Is that a fair analysis?
Yeah, that seems to be fair. I guess I don't know the area well enough to know if they get tornadoes and things of that nature.
Well, they did in that type of situation. Well, let me put it this way: it's described as one tremendous amount of water. You would have to have a tremendous wind to blow it dry enough that they could walk through the Gulf of Aqabah. And it would have to be in such a circular type of thing. I'm just talking off the top of my head. I'm not an expert on this. But it seems to be that you would have to, even Velikovsky, that was his rationale behind it as well, because he's looking for the practical side, not Yahweh's intervention. The wind would have to be in such a thing like a tornado or something that whirled around, it went off to a direction and dried it out for a little bit, because they stayed there for a day, you know, before they crossed over. Then they must have felt, they felt comfortable then, and they walked across, and then the wind turns back. And if all else fails, that's what the Torah says, and I'll stick with that till somebody can prove it wrong. So, but it would have to be something of that. But it was described as a gully, too. I think I have something on that in down here a little bit further as well.
Well, I'll gladly trust the Torah as well.
Yeah, well, when all else fails, read that one until they figure out how it's done. But I'm gonna throw something out. It's a little bit different. Just setting this up, because now we're moving into the area of the proving the Hyksos and the 11th. There's the 11th plague. And, of course, obviously the 11th plague is this invasion that happens. Hebrews have moved away. They have crossed over the Gulf of Aqaba. We have the Pharaoh's army wiped out. And now we have a void left, and we have people on the move, which we'll, if we get a chance later, we'll cover a lot of that detail as well. But here's an important inscription I wanted you to read wanted to share with you for a reason, because we're talking about who these people are, and it's so overwhelming that they're the Amalekites, and they're so overwhelming that they came from the southern part of Saudi Arabia and took over and became the Amu kings, the king shepherds. That's what Amu means in Egyptian. That is just blows me away. Now, we're going to fast forward in history for just a second, because we're going to read an inscription of Queen Hatshepsut, which is hard to say. And she came to power about two or three generations after the expulsion of the Hyksos. And that was long after the Hebrews had gone. And here's what she writes. This is kind of curious to me. She's a contemporary of King Solomon. She wrote, "The abode of the mistress of Kis was fallen in ruin, still fallen in ruin after all those years. The earth was swallowed, had swallowed her beautiful sanctuary, and the children played over her temple. I cleared it, and I built it anew. I restored that which is in ruins, and I completed that which was left unfinished. For that had been Amu in the midst of the delta, and in Havia, which is a name for Avaris or El Arish, where they found the stone. And the foreign hordes of the number had been destroyed and had destroyed the ancient works, and they reigned ignorant of the god Ra." That was from Spiros Antimidos, which is the inscription found by William Flinders Petrie, who was a rather famous historian and archaeologist, who also translated that. Menethos, we're back to him now, that wrote the Greek history. His volumes are, as we said, are not extant, but Josephus, not only did Josephus write down verbatim, also did Eusebius and Africanus. They record that their race bore a genetic name, Hyksos. We're only going through this because we're trying to figure out who these people are, because that's going to play a big role in the next 400 years of history of the Hebrews. The Hyksos, or Hyksos, which means king shepherds, from Hyk in the sacred language denotes king, and Sos in the common dialect means shepherd, forgive me. The combined words are Hyksos by Manetheos, or Manetho. It also can be, according to Josephus, the rulers, he also translated as the rulers of a foreign country. Now, the reason that's important is like a lot of people, I didn't read a lot of Egyptian history until I got kind of interested in it. They don't have any record of any of this in modern Egyptian history. There is no dark period, and this went on for 400 years. And there is no Hyksos kings, and the Exodus doesn't happen to about the 12th century BCE. Now, if it happened in the 12th century BCE, knocking down the walls of Jericho is what I'm trying to say, then there wouldn't be any walls there for him to knock down, because they fell in about 40 years after about almost around the 1500 mark. I'm sorry, the 1400 mark. So the reason these are important is kind of to put this whole picture together. And there's a little more to mention in the Torah about, there's very little more mention, rather, in the Torah about the events in Egypt post-Exodus. But Apura, he's going to complete the story for us. And he tells us that the invaders that vexed and tormented, this is quoting him, the invaders that vexed and tormented the land of Egypt, the tenth plague was not the last. Yet another one was to follow. A cruel conqueror invaded the once mighty realm, now overthrown and prostrate. He subjected it without meeting any resistance. He desecrated the sacred places. He raped its surviving women. He enslaved and decimated the population. This is Apura again. He utterly destroyed the temples, as if any remained erect. He robbed the sepulchres of the dead, and he mutilated the victims who remained alive. Man, these guys are can you say jihadist? The Amalekites came from Arabia, from Asia, according to Apura, and the Israelites left Egypt towards Asia, and they met. And we know that because the Torah is going to fill in some gaps now. So what we have is Egypt's in ruin. The Hebrews have crossed. The Pharaoh is dead. All his biggest army is gone. We have an invasion coming from Saudi Arabia by the Hyksos. And we're going to find out what happens next. The first encounter is before they, that being Israel, reached Mount Sinai or the Horeb. They met a horde of Amalekites, and that was at Meribah, which is the foot of Horeb, where the people thirsted for water, it says. And in the bed of the stony valley came Amalek, and fought with Israel in Rephidim. That's from Exodus 17:18. Moshe, Aaron, if you know the story, Moshe and Aaron and Hur went up to the top of the hill, and Yahusha, or he fought the Amalek. And at a point when the Amalek were winning a battle, but remember he asked them to hold up the hand, I'm going to call instead of Yahusha so you don't get confused, Joshua, on Exodus 17:13-16, Joshua discomforted, that's a mild word, discomforted the Amalekites and his people with the edge of the sword. And Yahweh said to Moshe, write this for a memorial in the book, for I will utterly put to out of remembrance the Amalekites under the heaven. And Moshe built an altar and called the name of it Yahweh Nissi, for he said, behold, Yahweh has sworn that he, Yahweh, being Yahweh, will have war with Amalekites from generation to generation. Now, the only thing I thought that was curious, and it's, maybe it's just me, Yahweh's saying he's going to fight these people forever, but he's going to put the name out of memory. And that's kind of what Egyptian history did, didn't it? There's no record of Amalekites. I mean, the record, we're finding the record, but there wasn't any record of it in any normal Egyptian history. I've looked at all the things. I can't find any of these kings, yet it's all over the place. And so we're going to prove what happens. We're going to prove that this is so. Okay. Because the Amalekites, here's what happened. The Amalekites divided into two parts. They went up through Canaan. And the other divided some of their army off, and they went to Egypt. They had heard rumors about Egypt being devastated and then the Pharaoh being killed. And the victory at Rephidim was very costly, where Moshe had won the battery, but they only prevailed after being really close to defeat. So that's where they first run across. This is when the Hebrew connection comes in, and they are fighting the Amalekites. The second encounter, because we're going to look at numbers, because the Amu migrated to Syria as well as to Egypt, and they shut off the south of Canaan. So when we look at that story, we have to go to Numbers 13:29, and it says that the Amalekite dwelled in the promised land of the south, which is south of Canaan. They got there first. They moved up and moved across, and if you remember, there at Horeb, the Hebrews are at Horeb. The Israelites had to have been, the Israelites had been hounded, rather, by these merciless powers across the desert, and that's recorded also in Numbers, and we'll get to that in a second. They were almost defeated at Rephidim, and now they've discovered that they were beat to the Promised Land and would have to fight them again to enter. Do you remember the story of the 12 spies that Moshe sends out, one of them being Joshua and the other one being Hur? And they, and 10 of them report that there's this horrible place, we're scared to death and everything. And he brought back the message, and then it's recorded in Numbers that all the people wept that night. Because in Numbers 14:1, they cried out, would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or that would God that we had died in the wilderness, 14:2. They became so afraid, Scott, that they wouldn't enter. And they were so scared, they even threatened, if you recall, to kill Moshe. So Yah turns around and he says, okay, we're strange people. We don't seem to trust Yah very much. Yahweh says, surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers. And therefore they spend 40 years in the wilderness. I have a question coming up in a minute, so to see what you think. In Numbers 14:42-45, Moshe said, they had decided they would turn around and, okay, well, if you're going to do that, then we're going to go up and fight them. But it says, too late. Moshe said to them, don't go up. Yah's not with you. He's not among you. The Amalekites, once again, we Amalekites, and the Canaanites are before you, and you will fall by the sword. And they went anyway and fought, and they were killed in huge numbers. There's a question. If they had followed Yah's advice, they would have prevailed the first time, right?
Yes.
He wasn't going to send them in there and not protect them. That didn't mean some people ain't going to get killed. People get killed all the time in these battles. God said he can save a remnant. He's not going to wipe them all out, but people do die. Let's flash forward for just a second, just to keep our perspective right. When the Magog War takes place and they invade Israel, he saves Israel, but a lot of people are going to die, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I mean, he's not changing the planning, and a lot of people would have died when they fought the Amalekites in there. But that was the price. That was what he asked them to do: is fight to get their land back. And
to be fair, everybody that's in the covenant will be gone by then, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah. But I mean, if you have to live through tribulation, you have to deal with tribulation, and some people will die, and some will fight, and they will die, and some people will die regardless. So I mean, someone probably died crossing the desert. You know, the Amalekites chased them behind them, and Yahweh talks about that later too. He talks about the Amalekites. So remember what he says to them. Remember what the Amalekites did to you out in the desert when you were crossing it. They just they found the old and the weak. Remember, you got 600,000 men, probably another million women and children, and you've got with them, and you've got also a big horde of Egyptians that came with them too. And the Amalekites are running all over the desert because they've been encountered all the same horrible stuff going on that they experienced, that the Egyptians were experiencing in Egypt. So they've left trying to find some place where they can live. So
well, and to be fair, I mean, like you're saying, just because he knows you and he cares about you, it doesn't mean you're not going to get sick. It doesn't mean you're not going to have pain in your life.
I know I'm going to die.
Well, yeah. Well, your body will.
Yeah, my body's going to wear out. My soul is the thing that I'm worried about. And that soul is the thing that Yahweh is always worried about as well.
And that's the thing that he said that will last forever.
Yeah. And he said, up to the end times, basically, they're going to be fighting the Amalekite, whether that's an Amalekite as a metaphor for an attitude of people, vicious people, or whether it's the Amalekite descendants, who can say. But what a horrible chain of events, I thought, because of what happened, because they didn't go take it when they had an opportunity when Yah was with them. If they had, what you'll find if you study the history a little bit, at least what I found when I was studying a lot the last few weeks, is that the Amalekites became so powerful, they dominated all those tribes of Edomites and Canaanites and all these sort of people, and even the Palestinians. They all joined the Amalekites and became vassals to them. The Amalekites were a rough crowd, man. And they took over. Those people, if they had beaten the Amalekites then, I'm not even sure those people would have been that rough. They developed in, and then when they didn't, let's think about this for a minute. When they didn't, then the what happens is the they get them 40 years out in the desert, and that's 40 years for the Amalekites to be entrenched in this. And they have built the thing. So now when they have to come back the next time with Joshua, you're fighting a whole nother animal. That's a whole generation now of well-entrenched Amalekite people. In that time, they have built up a great empire, which we'll find out. Now, here's where I have to leave it, because I know time is a little bit shorter, so let me say a couple of things here. If this is interesting to anybody.
We've got about 9 minutes, so we got some
okay,
time.
Okay, all right. Well, we can cover some more, but the problem is the Amalekites are, let me give you a little history just kind of off the top of my head. The Amalekites that we'll find out from all these other sources, and there's still tons to go about them, which I find is a fascinating story. I'll give you an overview. Is the Amalekites, just keep in mind, the Amalekites have come up, well, they had hundreds of thousands of army. They came up, filled the void. They went to Syria or Canaan. They conquered those people real quickly. They came under their subjugation. There is no army in Egypt. They took over Egypt. And we'll find out if we go through the next 400 years, we find out that they dominate the entire Middle East. And the from a Popey I all the way to a Popey II, the last one. And there's a parallel, which is really interesting, there's a parallel between all these events of the Egyptians and the Hebrews and the Amalekites. You know, for 400 years, they don't mention anything about any endeavors of an Egyptian pharaoh. This is from the book of Joshua through Judges. That's a 400-year period of time, and there's no record of any invasion, any enterprise of Egyptian pharaohs. But there's overwhelming information about the Amalekites. These people took over the whole group. Now, what we could do from this point on, in a limited amount of time, and if this is interesting and y'all want to listen some more, then we'll see if Craig wants to. But you can also go to Arabian accounts. I've got Abu Farajad. We've got Masudi, which some of these things are names from historians from the 9th century that are also well known to people who read the Prophet of Doom. They talk about the Amalekites in this same thing. We have Tabari. And then we also have accounts of Manetho, all the way from Josephus. We have some more scrolls that talk about all this detail that parallels the whole story of the Hebrews. We find out that in the period of Judges, this is interesting. Here's a clue. Let's do this one. Back to the Torah. The books of Joshua and Judges cover 400 years of history, which I just mentioned, with no mention of Egyptian domination in Canaan or any pharaoh military expeditions. It is because the Hyksos were the dominant empire over Egypt. Now, there's a story in Numbers 24-7. Balaam, you remember Balaam? He was a sorcerer and a prophet. He was called on to curse the Israelites, but instead he blessed them. In Numbers 24-7, he says, his seed, talking of Israel, his seed shall be in many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, or Apopi, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Now, there's no point in giving somebody a compliment and comparing him to some king who's not a big deal. He was the Amalekite pharaoh of Egypt and the ruler of the whole Canaanite area. In Judges 12:15. I'm sorry, Numbers, rather, 24:20, and this is Balaam again, and he looked at the Amalek, and he took up his parable, and he said, Amalek is the first among the nations, but he is, in his latter end, shall be, I'm sorry, but his latter end shall be that he perish forever. Now, if you are the first among nations, then that would be really in high cut. And he's the first among the nations. That would include Egypt. That would include all of Arabia. It would also include all of the Canaanites, all of Canaan and Syria, all the way up to the Assyrians. In Judges 12:15, Parathon is the land of Ephraim and the Mount of Amalekites. The Amalekites supported the Canaanites, and the Midianites actually controlled the Amalekites. Or controlled by, rather, the Amalekites. So anywhere we go, and there was just volumes and volumes and volumes of it, you will find that this story that is told is paralleled by all these different accounts as well. So I know we must be running pretty close on time, so I'm scared to jump into something else yet because it'll be kind of disjointed, and it's bad enough.
We're right around 3 minutes, so
we've got about
we
3 minutes.
Condense it into 3 minutes, otherwise we can.
Well, I can let me wrap something up.
Okay.
There's a couple of parallel stories in here. We've got the Amalekites, and the reason it's important to know about the Amalekites is because it parallels a story that goes from Moshe all the way through to Jeroboam. And what they're fighting is Amalekites. He said, Yahweh said, they're going to fight this forever. They're going to fight these people on and on and on and on, generation after generation after generation. Two things that help put all this together. One is, if you have a couple of dates and you know who this king is on this side, in this case Solomon, and we know who he is, who is the queen or the female pharaoh in Egypt, then we have a timeline. If we know who Jeroboam actually is, was in Egypt, he left before Solomon died, and he comes back and runs the northern tribes of Israel. He becomes the king of northern tribes of Israel. We know that he was in Egypt when Amenhotep was there. In fact, he married his daughter, and he became a vassal or a puppet king for the Egyptian pharaoh. We have two giant cultures that grow. When the Amalekites end, and we know who killed them, because the Torah is going to tell us. It's going to tell us that Saul, believe it or not, is the one that wipes out El Ardish, which is the big military base that the Amalekites used in order to control both empires, both the one in Canaan and the ones in Egypt. When Saul goes there to destroy them at the border of Israel and Egypt and destroys them, that pretty much is almost the final blow to the Amalekites. Then in turn, Samuel gets mad at him because he let the king off. He let Popey the second leave. Samuel goes down and takes care of him. And then it's kind of a mop-up job for David or Dod and Joab. And then you can trace all of that if you read all through that thing. And that was a little tedious, but you can put it all together. And all of a sudden you wind up with a parallel history there again from that point all the way through on who they fight, what this means. And this is all your history put together. We have a time, and then you can reestablish a timeline of Egypt so it's not so confusing. And you can, from there, you can project the whole thing back. It's a fascinating little story, at least it was to me. And hopefully some other folks might want to hear it as well. But
I do.
I thought.
I know I definitely do.
Do you? Well, yeah, we'll have to talk to him and see if he'll put up with me a little while then. Let me share that with it. But there was two things that we started out to do. We already did 1 through 9. The 10th plague, no matter which way you want to look at it, it happened. It's recorded everywhere. Yahweh was telling the truth. You can count on it. The 11th plague that Aporo talked about, that is not theoretically, is not right there in the Torah until you get further along when it's the story of the Amalekite nations, the Amus. Who took it over and what that means to Israel. And then the Egyptian story towards the end.